comments on our social pages, as your opinions will help us improve. Till next week, when we'll introduce you to other Iranian products, goodbye and God be with you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Colin Powell leaves behind a bloody legacy in West Asia, most notoriously his speech to the United Nations in 2003, in which he promoted false intelligence while making the case for the invasion of Iraq that led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by MEE staff. This article is titled, Colin Powell, U.S. General Leaves Behind a Bloody Legacy in West Asia. Stay tuned for more. Colin Powell, a retired four-star U.S. general, former White House National Security Advisor, and former Secretary of State, died on Monday, October 18th, after suffering complications from COVID-19. Powell, who died at the age of 84, was seen by many in Washington as a great public servant and was referred to as one of the finest Americans never to be president by former U.K. Prime Minister John Major. But he leaves behind a bloody legacy in the West Asia North Africa region, most notoriously his speech to the United Nations in 2003, in which he promoted false intelligence while making the case for the invasion of Iraq that led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians. Powell's experiences as a young soldier fighting in the Vietnam War led him to develop what he became known as the Powell Doctrine, a view by the general that if the United States had to intervene in a foreign conflict, it should deploy overwhelming force with mass troop deployment to crush its adversary based on clear political objectives. This idea would be the guiding force for Powell as he rose through the ranks of the U.S. military and later the American government and helped lead the country through various conflicts and operations in the West Asia-North Africa region. In 1986, while serving as an aide to then-Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger, Powell helped coordinate a series of airstrikes in Libya in retaliation for the bombing of a West Berlin nightclub that killed three people, including a U.S. serviceman. Washington blamed then-Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi for the attack. The strikes dropped 60 tons of bombs on the country and are believed to have killed a dozen Libyan troops. The bombing also hit a number of residential buildings and killed an unknown number of Libyan civilians. Despite the civilian deaths, the attack was deemed a success and Powell would move on to bigger roles in the U.S. military. Powell's most infamous moment was his defense of the decision to invade Iraq in 2003. That year, as Secretary of State, he presented to the UN Security Council the case for the U.S. war against Baghdad. He cited false information, claiming Saddam had secretly stashed weapons of mass destruction. He said in his 75-minute speech to the international body, "My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we are giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence." The subsequent U.S.-led war and occupation in Iraq dragged on for nearly a decade amid a grinding insurgency and led to the deaths of nearly 200,000 Iraqi civilians, as well as a number of cases of abuse, including the torture of Iraqi prisoners by the U.S. military at Abu Ghraib prison. He later called the speech a blot on his record, and in 2016 said the speech was a great intelligence failure. "I knew I didn't have any choice," Powell told the New York Times in July 2020. He said in reference to former President George W. Bush, who had asked him to speak before the UN, "What choice did I have? He is the president." In addition to the hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths, the American invasion of Iraq is believed to be the cause for the rise of Daesh, which took over swathes of Iraq and neighboring Syria and promoted another U.S.-led coalition to intervene in the country again. While the false information he presented to the UN tarnished his legacy, after several years out of office, Powell began to reemerge onto the American political scene. Despite being a Republican, he backed former U.S. President Barack Obama's campaign in 2008 and later backed Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton for president in 2016. As he came back into the spotlight as a moderate voice in American politics, Powell was also supportive of the Obama administration's use of armed drone strikes, which had resulted in scores of civilian casualties and was rife with a lack of transparency. He said in 2013, "Obama made it clear that there are still enemies out there that we have to deal with, but we will have to be more careful in the use of force, especially with respect to drones. drones are a very, very effective weapon, and we will continue to use them, but in a more circumscribed manner to make sure that we are going after high-value targets that present a real immediate threat to us, unquote. According to an investigation by Air Wars, the United States of America has conducted at least 91,340 air and drone strikes since 2001, killing at least 22,679 civilians and potentially as many as 48,308.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Face-off between the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro and the opposition led by Juan Guaido has put Caracas in a years-long political impasse and economic crisis. Several rounds of talks in recent years have been futile, and the two sides have failed to reach a consensus. In August, the Venezuelan government and the opposition began a new round of negotiations in Mexico City aimed at overcoming Venezuela's political and economic crisis. The dialogue was mediated by Norway. However, the latest developments have hampered the process of a possible settlement. Venezuela's government had decided to suspend the talks after Cape Verde extradited a Venezuelan envoy named Alex Saab to the United States on money laundering charges on Saturday. Saab was arrested in Cape Verde under a U.S. arrest warrant in June 2020 when his plane stopped there to refuel. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro lashed out at the U.S. for what he called kidnapping of an envoy to face an American court.
Saab was taken yesterday, skirting over everything. A plane arrived, assassins, hitmen came down. They sought him out and they removed him with blows from the jail he was held. They took him without advising lawyers, the family, nobody. A kidnapping by the United States government of an international diplomat.
Jorge Rodriguez, who heads the government's negotiating team, described the government's decision as a deep expression of protest over the brutal aggression against Alex Saab. He also called on Washington to release Saab immediately.
Venezuela is alerting the world that the life of Alex Saab is in danger. It's in the hands of judicial system that is directed at harming Venezuela. And we demand his immediate release by the American government.
The U.S. charged Saab in 2019 in connection with a bribery scheme and sanctioned him for allegedly orchestrating a corruption network that allowed Caracas to profit from a state-run food subsidy program. However, Saab's lawyers have denied the U.S. charges as politically motivated.
This is absolutely a political attack on Venezuela, and it is a kidnapping. This shows just how far in lawlessness the United States is willing to go and how much they are determined to attack Venezuela.
Meanwhile, U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido reacted to the decision to suspend the talks, accusing the government of evading the nation's problems. Caracas aims to ease U.S.-led sanctions on the Venezuelan nation, while the opposition says it aims to use the talks to secure guarantees for regional elections to be held in the fall. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed that Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. Then, the United States refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, imposed sanctions on the crisis-hit economy of the Latin American nation, and froze millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in the U.S. bank account. Washington has been using sanctions as leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro in what has been termed economic terrorism. Venezuela has faced chronic shortages of food and medicine as a result of U.S. sanctions, resulting in years of political and economic crisis.
Well, this is exactly what the U.S. government wants to prevent. And this may be also an effort on their part to sabotage even the negotiations going on in Mexico. That how can the talks continue under in this situation? But what needs to be condemned and denounced is depriving any country of food and medicine, particularly in this time of pandemic.
While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new, the U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of Maduro administration, but further complicate the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst a full-blown crisis. Seven people were killed and 60 others injured after a peaceful protest in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, turned deadly on Thursday. It all began as heavy gunfire erupted during a rally of Hezbollah and ML movement supporters to protest against a judge probing the last year's Beirut port explosion as they accuse him of political bias and being swayed by the U.S. Hezbollah Secretary General Syed Hassan Nasrallah has accused Judge Tariq Bitar of politically targeting officials in his investigation. The Beirut port blast in August 2020 killed over 200 people, injured around 6,000, and left some 300,000 homeless. It also caused further damage to Lebanon's already fragile economy. Following the unrest, Hezbollah and the ML movement in a joint statement said the attack was aimed at creating civil strife. Hezbollah initially blamed the attack on the Christian Lebanese Forces Party, led by Samir Jaja. Later, reports from Lebanon's Interior Ministry confirmed that the far-right Lebanese Forces Party had started the Thursday shooting in Beirut. Hezbollah accused the Lebanese Forces Political Party of taking orders from the United States and being financed by some Arab countries. The Lebanese president vowed to hold accountable the perpetrators.
What happened will be the subject of security and judicial follow-up, and I, for my part, will ensure that the investigation reaches the truth of what happened in order to hold those responsible and instigators to account.
Aoun described the incident as painful and unacceptable. So far, Lebanese authorities have arrested 19 people in connection with the violence.
Well, there is the uproar and instability and confusion in the region are directly attributable to the United States, to the apartheid entity of Israel, and to the repressive and repulsive monarchy of Saudi Arabia. So the whole issue is basically outsiders doing their best to destabilize the region.
Abdulbari Atwan, a well-known author, has described the recent highlights in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon as an American Zionist conspiracy to ignite a civil war in the region. Atwan stated that the U.S. Zionist conspiracy to create a sectarian conflict in the region will fail. He said sectarian conflicts have been created with the aim of securing Israel's interests and stealing Lebanese gas. But this sedition will not go ahead, and if it goes on, the U.S. and its allies will surely be defeated. In fact, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The US has attempted to weaken the resistance axis by hatching different plots, such as causing instability and wars in the region for years. However, the resistance has always been ready to properly respond to these threats. For instance, Washington has always sought to keep Israel's enemies at one another's throat so that they could not give Israel trouble. But the resistance front has time and again proven that it will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity, as it has launched retaliatory attacks against Tel Aviv, which have exposed the vulnerability of the regime's entities in the region. Israel's constant violations of Lebanese airspace are also a source of instability. This has been seen as a constant provocation by Israel, mainly directed at the resistance movement Hezbollah. Meanwhile, the US has also been accused of creating an atmosphere of instability. On the one hand, it has imposed sanctions on Lebanon, which prevents foreign investment in the country. It has even opposed the delivery of fuel shipments from Iran, is in an emergency mode due to a lack of fuel. Meanwhile, the US ambassador has stirred controversy by making anti-Hezbollah statements, so much so that a judge ordered a media ban on her. The trip by the number three diplomat at the State Department, Victoria Nolan, to Lebanon, also proved to be controversial. Her purpose was to meet government officials and representatives to discuss Lebanon's reforms and elections. The question that arises is, what does she have to do with Lebanon's elections? Nolan was famously accused of promoting regime change in Ukraine, backing the Maidan protesters and opposition, which showed how the Ukrainian opposition is being manipulated by Washington. Coincidentally, while she was there, the deadly protest in Lebanon erupted, which resulted in the death of several Lebanese. What is for certain is that the popularity of the resistance in the region will be a severe challenge for the enemies, who are hatching plots against them, specifically Israel and the US.
Israel has once again taken advantage of civilian aircraft covers to conduct airstrikes on Syria, a potentially dangerous move that could have resulted in an enormous tragedy. Israeli warplanes carried out strikes on the Palmyra area in the eastern countryside of Syria's Homs province. A Syrian soldier was killed and three others wounded in the attack.
They can commit crimes with impunity and feel that they have enough political cover because of their influence on the governments of the world, and which consequently influence the United Nations. They're backed by the United States, and their influence over the U.S. government and U.S. foreign policy is tremendous. They have more influence over U.S. foreign policy than U.S. citizens do.
A top Russian commander said in a statement that Syria decided not to use its air defense system to counter the Israeli attack, as two passenger airliners were flying in the area at the time. Israel has repeatedly used civilian aircraft as a shield against Syrian air defense systems in its aggression against the Arab country. In February 2020, an Airbus A320 with 172 passengers on board was forced to make an emergency landing at the Russian-operated Hamamim airbase during an Israeli attack. Back in 2018, Israel had to apologize for using a Russian reconnaissance aircraft as a shield during an attack, causing a Syrian S-200 surface-to-air missile to shoot down the Russian aircraft instead and kill 15 Russian and two Syrian service members. Iran's ambassador to the Vienna-based international organizations has criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency for its lenient approach toward Israel's nuclear program. Kazem Gharibabadi said silence and negligence toward the issue send negative signals to the members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. He expressed regret that the agency considers being outside the treaty as being exempt from any commitment and criticisms. He was responding to comments IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi made in an interview. When asked about the agency's focus on Iran's nuclear program and silence about that of Israel, Grossi argued that Tehran is a member of the NPT and must subject its nuclear sites to inspections and verifications, while the Israeli regime hasn't even signed the treaty.
You know, the UN does not condemn Israel because Israel has been very effective with their foreign policy and their intelligence operations infiltrating every other government on the planet. It's because of this that Israel can influence these governments to not take action against them either directly or via the United Nations, and that's why Israel gets away with this with no consequences.
Israel, which pursues a policy of deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, is estimated to have hundreds of nuclear warheads in its arsenal. The regime has refused to allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the NPT. The Israeli regime, which is West Asia's only possessor of nuclear arms, has so far assassinated 7 Iranian nuclear scientists. But Iran's calls on the international community to hold the regime responsible for its crimes have fallen on deaf ears. Iran says the silence will embolden the regime to expand its aggressive measures.
The world is in the midst of a global energy crisis. Prices in Europe, North America, and Asia have spiraled to multi-year highs in recent weeks. Energy demand is rallying as economies ramp up after the end of pandemic lockdowns, and there are dips in supplies from renewable resources. Energy demand is back today as the world economy reopens, but supply simply hasn't kept up. That is why U.S. oil prices have skyrocketed $120 since crashing to negative $40 a barrel back in April 2020, U.S. oil prices finished above $80 a barrel on Monday for the first time in nearly 7 years. High gas prices will only exacerbate elevated inflation and squeeze the budgets of ordinary families.
Well, we got a little bit of a return of demand as the growth comes off the floor during the COVID era here, and we got economies that are trying to recover. So there's a little bit of that going on. But because it's going on, I believe that global speculators are really responsible for most of the recent surge in global commodities in general, including oil, natural gas, and so forth.
In Britain, a shortage of the truck drivers who move fuel has led to panic buying amid fears of a shortage. After Brexit, many European truck drivers went back to their home countries and never returned. Some in Europe accuse Russia of deliberately restricting gas flows to the continent. But Russian President Vladimir Putin has brushed off allegations that Moscow is using energy as a weapon, saying that Europe's gas shortage is largely caused by systematic flaws in the continent's energy market. European electricity and gas prices have skyrocketed this year as tight gas supplies have collided with strong demand in economies recovering from COVID-19 pandemic. The International Monetary Fund says persistent supply chain disruptions and inflation pressures are constraining the global economic recovery from the pandemic.
I don't think, however, that this is going to continue for very much longer. The global economy is really weaker than some say. And I think when the GDP figures come out soon for the U.S. for the third quarter, fourth quarter, it will be clear that we don't have a runaway recovery. We have a rebound going on, but we don't have a really robust, sustained economic recovery.
Iran says it is ready to resolve the global energy crisis, provided that the oppressive U.S. sanctions are lifted. Oil Minister Javad Oji said that Iran has shown several times its goodwill to help stabilize the oil market and resolve the global energy crisis. However, illegal U.S. sanctions have hindered Tehran to reach that goal. He said that Iran has repeatedly declared that it would be able to swiftly increase its crude production to help alleviate the global shortage of fuel.
You know, the problem with natural gas is that the U.S. has imposed sanctions on Europe and others because it wants to export more natural gas. It's got an excess of natural gas, and that means it will dampen prices and profits of natural gas in the U.S. So the U.S. has had a policy since Trump of exporting and putting pressure on other countries to accept U.S. natural gas, even though it's more expensive than, say, Russian natural gas for Europe.
Europe is heavily reliant on energy supplies from Russia. Amid the current energy crisis, Ukraine and other Eastern European countries accuse Moscow of withholding gas supplies to pressure the West. The European Commission has announced a package of measures to alleviate an energy price surge that has sent bills skyrocketing across Europe. The approval of tax cuts and the joint purchase of fuel by EU members were among the proposals put forward. The European Commission has been under pressure to act on the price crunch. The wholesale price of gas has increased by 250% since January, triggering a knock-on spike in costs for consumers and businesses. However, countries like Iran and Venezuela are more than willing and more than able to provide the world with much-needed energy.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Biden administration invokes public health to justify the expulsion of thousands of people to danger in violation of both domestic and international laws of asylum, says Monty Zard, writer, in an article titled CDC's Title 42 Order Fuels Racism and Undermines Public Health in U.S. Stay tuned for more. America's top physician, Dr. Anthony Fauci, had a message for Republican officials who scapegoat immigrants for coronavirus spread. Let's face reality here. The problem is within our own country, Fauci explained in a recent interview on CNN, adding, focusing on immigrants, expelling them is not the solution to an outbreak. Dr. Fauci is not alone. Many public health experts like Americans themselves are alarmed that the tools of their trade are being weaponized against the most vulnerable among Americans. To this day, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, continues to back a pseudoscientific and discriminatory policy that the Biden administration uses to carry out mass expulsions of asylum seekers, such as the appalling recent scenes from Del Rio, Texas. Earlier this week, the Biden administration announced it intends to continue this policy despite the announcement that vaccinated tourists, shoppers, and visitors will now be able to cross the borders in addition to truck drivers and a long list of other persons dubbed essential who were permitted to cross throughout the pandemic. The recent announcement conspicuously left out one group yet again, asylum seekers. From its inception under the Trump administration, the misuse of Title 42 to block and expel asylum seekers, despite the objections of senior CDC experts and other public health professionals, was based on political rather than scientific considerations rooted in racist tropes and populistic untruths. Now, the Biden administration similarly invokes public health to justify the expulsions of thousands of people to danger in violation of both domestic and international laws of asylum. By continuing to stand by this policy, the CDC is sanctioning the ongoing politicization of the institution, weakening its authority, and decreasing public trust in the agency. In its most recent Title 42 order, the CDC notes the emergence of the more infectious Delta variant as a key reason for the continued expulsion of asylum seekers. However, the CDC acknowledges in that same order that mitigation measures such as masking and social distancing work to prevent the spread of disease. It even lauds the ongoing program for unaccompanied minors as an example of the protection that mitigation measures provide. The CDC claims that U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, lacks the capacity to implement such measures beyond minors are not tenable. The agency has an annual budget of $18 billion. Moreover, more than 20 months into the pandemic, we have a track record of successfully implementing such mitigation measures by agencies in other U.S. settings. The U.S. asks Pakistan, a country with a fraction of resources, to keep their borders open to Afghan refugees. Americans have certainly the capacity to do the same. The CDC also justifies the Title 42 order by citing the enhanced risks of COVID-19 transmission in congregate settings. This mistakenly assumes that asylum seekers must be detained, a practice long denounced as unnecessary, inhumane, and detrimental to the health of migrants and surrounding communities. Public health experts have repeatedly recommended other approaches to safely process asylum cases. Community-based initiatives such as the Family Case Management Program provide high compliance at a fraction of the cost of individual detention. Yet these approaches have been disregarded, as have public health measures that can mitigate disease transmission risks in instances where congregate setting for brief periods cannot be avoided. The U.S. has a long history of stoking fears of disease to galvanize support for anti-immigration policies. Border patrol agents on horseback terrorizing Haitian asylum seekers fits this tradition of xenophobia and racism. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis have blamed migrants for the increased rates of COVID-19 in their states. False narratives that epidemiologists and public health experts have debunked. Title 42 order helps to fuel this rhetoric. As part of its public health mandate, the CDC should dismantle troops that present migrants as vectors of disease rather than promote them. When public health policy is subverted to serve political agendas or to exclude, control, or discriminate against certain groups, we are all at risk. War, persecution, and torture do not pause for pandemics, and the right to seek asylum is enshrined in both domestic and international law. 20 months into this pandemic, we have an arsenal of proven public health tools, including testing, vaccines, and other common sense public health measures that would allow the U.S. to process asylum seekers effectively. It is time to definitively end Title 42.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Right.
around the world with reporters.
With a few days to go to the 4th Mustafa Prize, the laureates of the Science and Technology Award are gearing up to nab the prize. The 5 winners were announced on October 12th in a press conference held in the headquarters of the Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation. They're now in Iran, visiting different scientific entities, including Iran's High Council for Cultural Revolution. They're here to talk about their scientific achievements and the significance of the international prize.
I'm extremely happy to be selected for this prestigious Mustafa Prize. It's a big honor and a great privilege to see that our collective effort with international collaboration, Atlas, Antares, and KM3Net recognized with this prestigious prize. And I would thank a lot and all my gratitude to the Mustafa Foundation for this noble and for this exemplary manner they are doing their work to promote scientific excellence in the Muslim world.
First launched in 2015, the Mustafa Prize honors scientific breakthroughs in the Muslim world. It is awarded to Muslim scientists in 4 categories of information and communication science and technology, life and medical science and technology, nanoscience and nanotechnology, and all areas of science and technology. This year, out of 515 works submitted to the Iran-based Secretariat, 5 nominees were selected as winners. Laureates will be granted cash prizes amounting to $1 million.
In the last 4 decades, we have been working in the field of natural parachemistry, and that has resulted in the discovery of many drugs.
That's why you are going to receive the award.
Yeah, I feel extremely honored to receive this very prestigious award. This award is already very well known globally because of its excellence, and the quality of assessment to select people is absolutely wonderful.
The scientific event is held biannually during the Islamic Unity Week, which celebrates the birthday of Prophet Muhammad. This year, the award ceremony falls on October 21st in Tehran, with the attendance of 50 scientists and scholars from 15 countries. The Mustafa Prize says after 4 rounds, it has achieved its primary goal, to motivate Muslim scientists to compete for excellence. But the prize eyes for a bigger goal. It says it seeks to elevate science and technology in Muslim countries to, quote, revive the Islamic golden age in science. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In a televised speech, Hezbollah Secretary General accused the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader directly of conspiring to initiate a civil war.
I need to tell you very clearly, the real project for the Lebanese Forces Party is instigating a civil war, because a civil war will lead to demographic changes that would put the Christians in one area to create a Christian canton controlled by the Lebanese Forces Party. There would be no place for anyone else in this area. This is our understanding of our experience with the Lebanese Forces Party and the path it is taking. One example is that they were ready to give the service of starting a civil war on behalf of the former Saudi ambassador Sabhan.
The leader of the resistance said the Lebanese Forces Party is trying to incite Lebanese Christians against Hezbollah, presenting it as an enemy. Said Nasrallah gave a detailed explanation of last Thursday's events, stressing that the security apparatus gave Hezbollah a confirmation that the first bullets were fired by militiamen from the Lebanese forces against the unarmed protesters. This, he says, was all part of a plan to drag Hezbollah specifically to internal conflict orchestrated by foreign sides. Nasrallah said the U.S. is also trying to provoke an internal conflict in Lebanon the same way it did in many other nations. Yet Sayyid Nasrallah stressed the scheme will not succeed.
Hezbollah has 100,000 fighters. We did not prepare them to fight a civil war. We prepared them to defend Lebanon and our land and water and petrol and natural gas, which is being stolen under our watch. We prepared them to protect the Christian and Muslim towns in Baal Bag al-Hermel. We were killed in Kaldeh and we were silent. We were killed on Thursday and we were patient. It does not mean we are weak or incapable. We are thinking straight and we have ethics. I tell the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader, don't miscalculate, be disciplined. Learn from your wars and learn from our wars.
He warned that in the event of a military conflict, neither Israel nor the U.S. or Saudi Arabia will come to the help of any warring side.
Sayed Nasrallah was clear in proving that the Lebanese forces had always tried to target the resistance, but he was also clear in the fact that Hezbollah will not be lured into internal fighting and that the resistance is a protector of civil peace and unity of Lebanon. And those who are pushing for civil war are at the service of a U.S. project in Lebanon and the region.
Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech tonight that the main guarantor for peace and stability is the Lebanese state and the Lebanese army. Therefore, Hezbollah will put its trust in the judiciary to bring those who martyred people on Thursday to justice. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Despite the harsh living conditions caused by the years-long Saudi war and siege, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and 13 other cities to celebrate the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary.
Today, the Yemeni people mark this occasion and tell the world that we can overcome all challenges by trusting God. Despite suffering from brutal aggression, suffocating siege, and limitless conspiracies, Yemenis have managed to achieve victories.
Yemenis said they gathered to send a message to the world that Islam is the religion of peace and so it's a prophet. They called on other Muslim nations to mark this day to renew their loyalty to the Prophet Muhammad.
Islam is a religion of peace. Our nation will stick to its identity and values regardless of wars and aggressive policies. Problems have only strengthened us in the face of the enemies of Islam.
For centuries now, Yemenis used to mark the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary as part of their religious culture. Such ceremonies include various cultural and religious events, like reciting verses from Holy Quran.
Dressed in green, the color of peace and mercy, Yemenis celebrate the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, which is a great blessing for the whole humanity. People, he say, Muslims around the world should follow the footsteps of the Prophet and stand against the enemies of Islam. Al-Ratif Washali, Sana.
Thousands of Muslims gathered in the English town of Bolton on Sunday to celebrate a joyous occasion, the birthday of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad. The birthday of the prophet, also known as Maulid al-Nabi, is commemorated in Rabi al-Awwal, the third month in the Islamic calendar.
These local Muslims are very excited about coming out to commemorate this day, as last year coronavirus restrictions prevented them from doing so. However, things are now returning to normal here in the UK, and these Muslims are coming out in strong numbers from across the country to commemorate the beloved birthday of Islam's holy prophet.
Apart from bringing Muslims together, it also provides a great opportunity to spread his legacy to non-Muslims too.
This is our message to everyone. All the humankind, you know, in this planet, that we should live each other with love and harmony. And the teaching of our Holy Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is for all humankind. So this is why we are celebrating today.
In recent months, the beloved Prophet has been the target of insult in Europe. But these Muslims hope to break the many misconceptions.
It's been happening over a number of years. There's been very negative propaganda against Islam and particularly Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. But having said that, people with bitter common sense, they try to study Islam, try to learn Seerah of Islam, and you'll be amazed, most of them become Muslim.
And when he studied different aspects of his life, his childhood, him as a husband, him as a father, him as a friend, him as a leader of his community, then he realized what a great person he is. And he'll get rid of a lot of the misconceptions and misunderstandings. And once you do some research and you speak to Muslims and you study his life, it'll enlighten you and, you know, you'll hold him in a very high regard.
In addition to prayers, Quran readings and the march, sweets and free ice cream were handed out, all in honour of the Prophet's generous nature. Robert Carter, Bolton.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat are asking the Nigerian court to enforce their fundamental right to movement by ordering the Nigerian Department of State Services to release their passports. The case, filed by Zazaki's lawyers at the Federal High Court, Abuja, indicated that the secret police have placed a red flag and travel restrictions on the passports of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife.
We made several frantic efforts to get his passport back from them, so that now the trial having been concluded and they having been discharged and acquitted, we made requisitions to the states to avail them their passports so that they can, as British citizens, travel out. But the states turned down this request.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat need their passports to travel for urgent medical treatment abroad. Zazaki's lawyer said that placing restrictions on the passports of the Islamic cleric and his wife constitutes a threat to their lives. The case has just been filed and will only come up for hearing when it has been assigned to a judge. But Zazaki's lawyers are optimistic that the hearing will commence soon.
Sheikh Zazaki is reported to have a dangerous and an unusual amount of lead and cadmium in his blood when he was shot by Nigerian security forces. His doctors have since advised that Zazaki be immediately hospitalized to remove the dangerous substances from his body. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
The olive harvest season has started in the occupied Palestinian territories, but instead of being a festive season, it's been overshadowed by the sporadic attacks by Israeli settlers. Like previous years, we visited the village of Al-Mghayyar, northeast of the occupied Ramallah, where Israeli settlers vandalized over 100 olive trees a while ago. One of the landowners told us that settler attacks on the groves have escalated during the autumn harvesting season.
The settlers do whatever in their power to prevent us from harvesting. They till our crops, destroy our lands, and sometimes burn our trees. They try to keep us away from our lands. 2 days ago, over 100 olive trees were destroyed. The settlers are protected by Israeli forces.
As Palestinian farmers here and other villages suffer an almost daily act of aggression by Israeli settlers, a popular campaign called Faza has been launched to protect farmers. These areas are considered to be at high risk of settler attacks during the harvest season. Supported by the Committee Against the War Land Settlement, the campaign has attracted volunteers including university students, farming committees, local councils, and residents of the villages.
Every year, Palestinian farmers come under attack by the settlers in areas close to Israeli settlements. We have come to Al-Mughayyar village to help Palestinian farmers in harvesting their products as quickly as possible and protect them against settler attacks.
Al-Mughayyar is surrounded by a number of settlements. Israeli settlers attack Palestinian farmers on a daily basis, but when we appear in groups, our farmers feel safer and the settlers won't dare to attack them.
The vandalism by the extremist settlers have persisted year after year during the olive harvest season in recent years. Observers say these settlements have been set up to encircle Palestinian areas to make life harder for Palestinians.
Olive harvest has never been easy for Palestinian families living close to Israeli settlements. Olive harvest is considered by many of them as a way to stay connected to their land and protect it against the Israelis. This land has been a source of food and income for Palestinian families for generations. Mona Qandil, Al-Mughayyar village, northeast of occupied Ramallah.
From the 2019 anti-government protests in Lebanon to the 2020 explosion in Beirut port, the documentary delves into the heart of the historic incidents to shed light on the truth. Directed by Lebanese filmmaker Sahar Hossein Ghaddar, the feature documentary was premiered in Tehran. Over the course of the filmmaking, Sahar attended the 2019 nationwide protests, which she says were sparked by economic mismanagement and corruption, but were wrongly portrayed to be against the resistance movement.
The 2019 demonstrations were born out of people's pain and hardship and sought to put an end to 3 decades of corruption entrenched in the ruling system in Lebanon. People from all walks of life, including supporters of the resistance movement, were among the protesters. But Israeli opportunists tried to hijack the protest and say that the demonstrations were triggered by anti-Hezbollah sentiments.
The documentary also reviews the August 2020 blast at the port of Beirut, which killed 219 people. No one has yet been charged in the 14-month probe into the incident. However, Hezbollah has been critical of Judge Tariq Bitar for weeks, accusing him of singling out Hezbollah-affiliated politicians for questioning over the explosion. Last week, six pro-Hezbollah protesters were shot dead by anonymous gunmen during a demonstration by resistance groups who called the investigation politicized and demanded the removal of Judge Bitar.
Israeli footprints can be traced in the case that investigates the Beirut explosion. Israel and the U.S. seize any chance to deal a blow to our country and the resistance axis. What Mr. Bitar is doing serves the interest of our Israeli and American enemies by trying in vain to implicate Hezbollah in the Beirut port blast. And we saw a few days ago that our peaceful protests against Bitar were faced by sniper bullets shot by Lebanese forces faction from a Christian neighborhood.
Last year's port blast happened after a fire detonated nearly 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate, a combustible chemical widely used as agricultural fertilizer that had been stored unsafely in a port warehouse for almost 6 years. Based on information provided in the documentary, senior Lebanese officials were aware of the material's existence and the danger it posed, but failed to secure, remove, or destroy it.
The documentarian says her film tries to expose what she calls a string of lies that seeks to smear the resistance axis. She says that string is pulled by Israel, stressing that she and her fellow Lebanese youth demand a strong government and judicial system that are independent of Israeli manipulation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Anger boiling on the streets of Karachi. People have come together to denounce the recent deadly attacks on two Shia mosques in the neighboring Afghanistan, Kunduz and Kandahar, that took the lives of over 100 worshippers. Protesters are outraged at what they call the global powers' failure in Afghanistan that led to the chaos and instability there. They say those powers are responsible for the recent bloodshed in the war-torn Afghanistan. Protesters chant anti-Israel and anti-US slogans and stress the need for unity among Muslims.
We were martyred in mosques, we were martyred on roads and processions, but we never backed off from our stance of following the footsteps of Hussein ibn Ali. It is the responsibility of Kabul government to provide security to Shia Muslims in Afghanistan, otherwise Taliban government can never get away with global criticism.
Fear looms large that the government in Kabul is unable to curb terrorist groups like Daesh terrorist group, who has claimed the attacks.
We are here to show solidarity with our brothers and sisters whose loved one became the victims of brutal terror attacks in Kunduz and Kandahar Shia mosques in last two Friday prayers. U.S. shameful withdrawal from Afghanistan brought us to this day, where our brothers and sisters are not safe.
Protesters also called on the Pakistani government to take up issue with the Afghan government. They said the international community should not remain silent towards the crimes being committed against Shia people of Afghanistan. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
Following fierce clashes with the Saudi-led coalition's forces and terrorist groups, Yemen's armed forces successfully liberated 3,200 square kilometers in Marib and Shabwa provinces, Bayhan, Ain and Usaylan directorates of Shabwa, as well as Abdiya and Harib of Marib were liberated during the operation named Spring of Victory.
Our armed forces have managed to accomplish a Spring of Victory operation in the Marib and Shabwa governorates and achieve their goals. By the operation, the army liberated vast areas amounting to thousands of square kilometers.
Yemeni officials say the recent victory was made in two strategic provinces with the cooperation of tribesmen in most of the liberated areas.
The significance of the operation lies in the importance of the two governorates in which the battle took place, namely Marib and Shabwa, which are oil-rich and strategic. This operation will have a direct impact on the Saudi-led coalition. The tribesmen played an unprecedented role in liberating these areas.
Earlier, the spokesman of the Yemeni army had announced that the armed forces liberated 600 square kilometers in the oil-rich province of Marib. Vast areas in Marib and Shabwa provinces have been captured by the Yemeni army, which means that the armed forces will go further in their efforts to liberate the eastern Shabwa province after liberating the whole province of Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen.
عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنعاء.
Kandahar Mosque Blast was the deadliest incident since the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan in August. It was the second week in a row that a Shia mosque came under an attack planned by Daesh terrorist group.
I
think Daesh attacks must be considered as crimes against humanity.